Is it possible for you career switchers out there to kind of leapfrog juniors when you are switching careers over to tech? That's the kind of question we're going to tackle this week on Shop Talk Show, episode number 242. We have a lot more in here. What about like Safari? Is it the jankiest of browsers as far as animation is concerned? I'm not sure, but we're also going to dig into how you might diagnose some of those jankiness problems as well. We're going to talk about having pride in your work. We're going to talk about style guides. We're going to talk about grid layout again and kind of the situation there and how you can think about it. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff about freelancing and ownership of things. And we're going to talk about a thing that I didn't know much about, but Dave apparently had all the answers for, HSTS. That and more coming up on this week's Shop Talk Show, which is sponsored by two lovely hosts. One of them is Media Temple, the hosting that CSS Tricks is on and Shop Talk is on and parts of CodePen are on. It's the hosting provider that I've trusted forever. We're going to tell you more about some of their services later in the show. And Indeed Prime. Indeed Prime helps tech talent, such as software developers like you, land their dream job. So the idea is you sign up for it and the job offers come to you. We'll tell you about that and more coming up soon. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, shopping maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about websites. That's it. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Let's talk about websites.
Hi, welcome to my website.
Yep, we're recording this just 2 days after the election, in which all the people in my world were not feeling very good about. So it was kind of a sad kind of a...
Been a somber bit of a week, but, you know, that's it. I think it's just, we know a lot of people, come across a lot of different people, and I think a lot of people are kind of affected by this thing, so... Anyway, not a political podcast, but
democracy happens and we move on. And you know what we can do, Dave, is help people out and do a good job and live our lives in the best way we possibly can. So one of the ways that we help people out in this world, Dave, is by answering their questions on Shop Talk Show.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of anything at all. In fact, sometimes they don't even send us your name. So I have no idea what political leanings you have or gender or race or anything. There's an anonymous question that we'll get to next. This first one, though, is from Mr. Ryan Miller, who writes in, I've noticed that websites on desktop, not iOS, Safari, seem to be much more janky than other browsers. Why is this? Do you know of any tools that can help in measuring and improving jank? Something like Google Page Speed or Insights or Pingdom or whatever. Like, you know how those two, like Google Page Speed or Pingdom or whatever, gives you like, I don't know, heuristic information that's like, your website has these problems. Your website has this much uptime. Your MySQL is taking this many seconds to do its thing. Is there, this website has animation jank? Is there a tool like that? I think it's kind of maybe yes and no.
If I was president of the web, I would deport Safari.
Worse? Is Ryan right? I never seem to notice it as being the worst offender in that regard.
So Safari is, I think Safari is, has the, you know, there was that post by Nolan Lawson, sort of famous, Safari is the new IE, and now Nolan works for Edge, which, wow, what a cosmic twist of events. But Safari is on an annual release cycle. There is that technical preview that is actually kind of okay and kind of gives you a hint at the cool stuff WebKit is doing.
It's funny but that Nolan...
I don't use it. It's not available on my Windows machine. So
who's behind the recent
progressive enhancement hoopla too. Apparently no stranger to big statements that cause drama.
I think he's good at punching the old bee's nest, if you will. So he's pretty good at it. But that's good. I feel like that's how we get discussion. And if he was like unthoughtful, I think it would be like, dude, shut down your Medium blog. But he is very thoughtful. He tests things out. You know, he's doing things about like Webpack and node modules now. It's basically like, yeah, it doesn't work on a phone. So there's stuff to read there on Nolan's blog. But Safari is on an annual release cycle, which means it doesn't, you know, you have to wait a long time. So while Chrome may have fixed some weird, you know, super rendering thing or scrolling performance, you know, Safari will take a while to do that. Is Safari janky? I don't really know. And then how...
Well, let's assume that it is, though, or
let's
whatever.
Let's say it is. Let's say you...
Is there a tool where you just type in a URL? In fact, I just saw a really cool one that I've been trying to test out, but it's been throwing errors for me. Not animation related, but it's called Form Linter that Thoughtbot put out, which I just think is the coolest idea ever, where you just like send it the link to a web page with a form on it, and it's like, oops, you missed this label input connection, or you know, it like gives you like data like that, like, you know, here you get a C- for this form because of these problems, which I think is so cool. I don't think you can send, I don't even know if it's possible to build a tool that's like, you get a C- for the animations on this page, because like what would you test example? Or I guess it could run, okay, I'm bouncing all around here, but have you ever seen like a let's debug the animation jank on this website post, which is like a Paul Irish thing, it's a Paul Lewis thing or whatever, and they're cool, and they're like, I'm going to throw up the Chrome DevTools here, and then I'm going to hit record, and then I'm going to scroll down the page a little bit, and it's going to record some data about what's happening on this page. See these red bars? That's when it dips below 60 frames a second or whatever. That's a problem area. Let's zoom in and look at it. These are the frames that it's painting. These are the elements that are affected. And you're like watching them diagnose it, and you're like, whoa, that's so cool. In my experience, it ends up being a little harder than what those make it out to be, because I'm like, all right, what tabs do I click on again? When do I hit record? And then it seems like in some of these posts, there's like a logical jump that happens that I couldn't follow. They're like, oh, well, it must be this box shadow then. You're like, oh, shoot, how'd you get to box shadow from what you were just looking at? I don't get it. That's the, you know. So it seems like the tools are kind of there and there's some cool possibilities. It's not as easy as toss this URL at a thing and it'll give you some information. But, like, you can, at least in Chrome DevTools, get some, like, problematic paint information and stuff. I don't know if Safari has those same tools.
Yeah, I think Chrome maybe went like when it forked to Blink, it kind of the dev tools really changed, you know, and kind of went a way different direction than Safari.
Or it's Safari, not like Safari actually just did nothing with their dev tools.
No, I'm sure something like that exists in Safari, but you could, you know, you could see your Chrome and start detecting problems there. You know, there's sort of two things you want to look for when you run that thing, the web inspector. And dude, I go to bed every night and I pray and I say, you know, could I please understand the web inspector one day? That's my dream. That's my hope and dream. I'm like, one day I'm going to understand it and I'm going to unlock a world of profiling and it's going to be wonderful. Here's two things I know. Can I tell you three? Can I tell you three things I know, Chris?
Yes.
There's on that profiler, when you check all the things and you just say, yep, it worked. I'm just the full check, buddy. And you check the profiler in the timeline. Or is it timeline? Or no, it's it is timeline. Network is the...
And you know what? I'm looking in Safari right now, and it's also called timelines, and you can also hit a record button and see stuff. I don't know. I don't just know enough to know which is better than the other, but okay, go on.
Okay. So there's in Chrome, there's a little green line, and that's your FPS, and that is basically your jank measurement. If it gets low, and I think by low, that means it goes... It the bar goes higher, that's counterintuitive, but I think the bar goes higher when you're kind of like lower FPS. Okay. Like 60 is the bottom and 30 is the middle and you know, zero is the top.
Okay, so you want to be above the middle?
Well, you kind of don't want to see, you kind of don't want to see a green line. You want it just to kind of work. I could be way off. I might be opposite.
Somebody, I don't know. I'm just on some boring website right now. It's just some text on it. And I hit record and just started like selecting some text and stuff. And even that, you can kind of like see the GPU doing stuff and stuff. But it's all green. It's all like above the middle, which I'm like, I think that's good.
Yeah, I'm gonna profile my site here real quick. DaveRupert.com, the fastest website. Thanks for the
worst radio ever. I'm looking at a really complicated chart, and I can't explain it at all. Just picture it in your mind, though.
picture in your mind what I'm doing, okay? I'm pretty sure when that little green bar gets high, or gets tall, that means you have bad FPS, okay? But they don't label it. What a terrible chart. I'm so angry. Okay. But, and then there's two other things you can kind of see. There's the flame chart, which is that big thing where like all the calls kind of stack on each other. And when they stack on the higher the stack, the kind of more JavaScript you're doing. And that's taking a long thing. Chrome also has this thing called a long frame, which is kind of this big red line called long. If you hover over, it'll be the red things in your above your FPS meter. That's a big deal. Long frames are a big deal.
Okay.
That means like you're using a bunch of memory. And so like if frames are hitting late, that means like you've got bad FPS kicking in. The other thing, and I picked this up from like an Alex Russell video, is the yellow. Okay. On the CPU meter, the yellow slug, which is what Alex Russell called it, the yellow slug is, that's like your CPU being occupied, and then your page isn't interactive until that tapers off and the gray kind of like shows up and tapers off. So your page isn't interactive until that yellow stuff quits.
Interesting. That's real bad if you see yellow.
If you have a big yellow slug, like a big, you know, thousands of milliseconds of slug, that's the thread being occupied, and that's bad. Those are the like three or four things I know about this. I try to grok this thing. The documentation on Web Inspector, God bless the Chrome team, but it is so bad.
Also, like, okay, so you see some problem. Let's say you decide to do this in Chrome or what. I know we started this talking about Safari. So, like, if you fix a bunch of stuff in Chrome, there's a decent chance, I'd say, that it gets better in all browsers, but maybe not. Like, it's not, I mean, you're fixing it for one particular browser, so, but still, I mean, whatever it is that you change to fix these things, which that's the other part of this that we haven't got into at all. Like, what is it exactly that's the problem? It's like, oh, shoot, I guess I should have had a transform on that. Oh, shoot, I should have wrapped this in a request idle callback. Oh, shoot, I'm using a set timeout where I should have been using a request animation frame or something. The fixing of it is often like, oh,
yes, I agree. Don't know. I'm just like, how do you debug a third party problem? How do I know? Like, how would I even begin to like figure that out? And I don't know, but they do. That's what the Chrome team, I feel like they do, is they're just like, oh, here's your problem. You had a extra semicolon on your, you know, your 500th JS file. That's your problem. And I don't get it. And I want to be there.
Yeah, that's the logical leap part that's a little tricky. But at least if you can target it to an element on the page through this tool somehow, that would be interesting. Or if you know, or whatever. Like, I think it just narrows where you're looking from absolutely anything to particular elements or particular interactions or particular areas of the page.
Right, and like Safari and like Chrome may be different. You know, they may be like, like Chrome might have something optimized that Safari doesn't, and that's why you're seeing it. But those two are very similar in their, like, you know, historical code base that I think you could probably use them as comparisons. So
Anonymous writes in, love the show. two things. Do you take less pride in your work the older you get? I'm fairly new to the business, and sometimes I find it embarrassing to release some of my work when it's not as pretty or as effective as I'd like it to be, even though my customer is happy and my bank account is even happier. So you're producing work that you don't even love necessarily, but otherwise all is well in the world. I don't see any problems at all there. If I'm not proud of it, it's not going in my portfolio because that feels weird. But I'm also maybe not going to keep doing it because happy customers and happy bank account is a happy me.
I believe it was Steve Miller who said, go on, take the money and run.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a joker and a smoker and a midnight toker, though. So how do you believe what he said?
Very unethical source. But he... Hey,
smoking weed isn't unethical.
Why in some states?
Law isn't
I think this is the thing. Do you take less pride in your work the older you get? I don't know. I think you'll always enjoy work at some point.
I don't think age and pride are not connected.
Yeah, I think that. But do you like? As you get older, do you have a growing body of work you don't show people? Oh, most definitely. I mean, that's how it is. I have those sites and Chris, I'm sure you probably have those or something, but there's stuff you don't show. That's fine. Not everything's a home run or not everything's like the best it's ever been. And, I think,
show whatever you want. Show whatever you want. Show what you're proud of. Show what makes you the most money. Show it. You know the answer to this already, Anonymous. They also ask, though, there's so much talk. Dave, I know you've been hearing so much talk. It's like the zeitgeist of 2000, the last few years, at least anyway, is style guides, mm-hmm. right? And even putting animation in those style guides. Anonymous wants to know, how do you find customers with the money to support such a heavy process? Which is kind of a loaded question. But we'll go with it. And then he kind of ends with like, I'd love to do something more complex than ease out or whatever. So he's kind of saying like, hey, like, let's say I want to make style guides part of my process. He's not having clients that are on board with that necessarily, because I think Anonymous is saying, what is that going to like double the amount of dev work is to not only build the site, but build a style guide with it. Do you agree with that premise?
I would say it's an exercise, right? Like it takes time to find something, but I think this is maybe something you do. This is weird, but if you know how to do this, if you know how to do good animation, like that should be like a bonus add-in to your work. And then kind of like if you go to like the Valhead Sarah Drasner episodes of our show, you find the, like, if you know how to do it, you know what's good for certain situations. You like have a good understanding of animation theory, like when you would add in animation, kind of what is your intention with animation. I think it doesn't like add a bunch of cost if you know how to do it. Does that, you can be like,
that's exactly what it makes me think of. If you have 5 years of muscle memory of building client sites where you just build it how you build it, you just rock and roll and do your own thing, and it doesn't involve a style guide of any kind, and now all of a sudden you're like, I'd like to make a style guide. Yes, it's going to take you more time and effort and money or whatever to get that done. If you have 5 years of muscle memory of building sites, style guide first, then it's just how you work. It's just the way it is. It's the change that's what's difficult here. I mean, I just was reading Brad Foss, final finished copy of Atomic Web Design. That's his muscle memory. That's how Brad works. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's above and beyond for him to produce a site in that way that kind of inherently then produce a style guide-like system.
Yeah, I'm thinking like, if you have two clients, let's say one's a tech company, they do computers or something, make computers. Like, you're not going to have like a big bounce animation on this computer company, right? It doesn't make sense. Like, why would a computer like go boing on the web page? Didn't we talk about like mouth sounds are the only way to describe animation? But if you're doing, I don't know, like a pizza website. You could, it could, a pizza could maybe go boing onto the page, you know, why? Because it, pizza's fun, pizza's happy. You know, but I, you know, the computers doesn't boing onto the page. It is not, that is not what computers do. So I think when, like, if you're good at animation, you, it's not hard to integrate this into your process. Like what is kind of, expected, you know, but I'm thinking about like other things, like people just like fly in paragraphs and stuff when you scroll or whatever. Whenever I see that, I think people just added that in. They didn't think about it because I don't know who wants to have a paragraph just fly in. No one wants that. So what, like, I'm just like, what, like, I don't know. I think like you got to be careful. Like I think some people just add animation because they're just like, I'm doing it. I love it. It's so immersive. Great. And like you got to really think about when you're adding animation and what you're communicating. And I think that's.
I saw a kitchen sink site the other day that it was so over the toply designed. And everybody's seen a site like this that I really thought it was distracting. I like tried to get my mind to be like, okay, what is this page trying to tell me? What is this page? I tried to focus and my mind wouldn't do it. It wouldn't tell me. It was a weird moment.
Oh, there are times I'll scroll a page and I'm on a mouse wheel, like on my Windows machine. So it's like, it's different. You got to test these things on mice with mouse wheels, not just your magic touchpad. I'll like scroll and like, I'll just see like three columns, just kind of, I know it's three columns cause there's some like a button living there, but like, and I'm just waiting. I could like start a stopwatch on my wrist and just be like, okay, when do the images show up? And there they are. Like, it's just, you gotta be careful. That's me being picky. Too anonymous. I think there are customers out there. I mean, these are probably bigger customers who like have big important needs, but you know, maybe there's, maybe there's room to get good at it with these smaller customers. I mean, it's not unheard of to like put extra, I'm going to say it's not unheard of to like put extra work into something. If you're learning something, you know, like if you're learning how to do animation well, it might pay off. It might be distracting, but like you need to learn how to do it. So, and then it shouldn't be like a big expensive thing to drop into somebody's, you know, system.
All right. I think that's pretty good stuff. Let's do another one. We have Justin
Leatherwood writes in, I'm working on my own personal site and wanted to avoid using Bootstrap's grid to try and learn how to do layouts myself. I like it. I followed CSS Tricks article, Don't Overthink It Grids, and had some success. I think I heard you guys say you use Flexbox nowadays for layout, but I always read in CSS Tricks Flexbox guide, Flexbox layout is most appropriate to the components of an application in small scale layouts, while grid layout is intended for larger scale layouts. When do you guys think grid versus Flexbox versus create your own grid system? When do you guys use grid versus Flexbox versus create your own? Wondering if you found one is better than another for implementing mobile responsiveness.
We've talked about this stuff a little bit recently. Mm-hmm. The question, it meanders a bit in that it starts off with like, I want to use Bootstrap to do layouts myself. That's pretty cool. I have no particular problem with that. I just was pontificating the other day that I think being empowered to do layout is possibly the most important hurdle in being comfortable and just like kind of being a CSS person.
I agree.
And that everybody that I know who is a kind of afraid of CSS but otherwise does web stuff, I think layout is their biggest fear. You know, like they can change some colors and fonts and maybe some padding and stuff, but they freeze when it comes to kind of an overall layout for a page. If you need a little help to get on with that and you want to use Bootstrap's grid or whatever, I think that's particularly fine. My article was a lot of these grid frameworks are lots and there are 12 columns. There are a ton of pre-prescribed classes. And they're complicated and can, you know, bloat gets thrown around a little bit more than I like, but maybe have some of that element of bloat. And mine was like, I never, ever use those. For some reason, I need to make three columns. I just am like, oh, I know how to make three columns. You make them 30% wide and do a little tiny bit of math, maybe even with calc and CSS, to account for the spaces between them if necessary, which isn't even always necessary. And you got a grid. You know, it's like, wow, the reaching for frameworks all the time is just – it just has never sat well with me because I'm like, I don't know. I never get to that moment where I need it. So if you're specifically asking about that article – that was the point I was trying to make in it. And then so many people like come to that article and grab the code out of it and use it like a framework. And I'm like, oh, damn, that's not the point at all. But whatever. And now Flexbox is here. And that particular article was written before Flexbox. I may have updated it and made a new one. I'm like, this got even easier. Now you can, now here's a grid framework, grid display flex. Now, like every item in that is on a horizontal row, and it's like, of course you may need to tweak stuff like that, but maybe you don't even need to. You know, if you just like have a row that you wanted to make kind of like a horizontal list of stuff like navigation or whatever, that might be a one liner. Or if you just then select the child elements and say flex one, it'll share the space between all them. There's all these powerful stuff you can do there. So don't overthinking grid did get even easier now that Flexbox is here. And the fact that it can wrap, there's all this powerful stuff. It makes the setting it up even easier. And now I think a lot of people, this is worth drilling into people's head. Flexbox is a one-dimensional system. I said horizontal row. You can switch it to go vertical as well. That's fine. You can make it wrap, which makes it feel a little two-dimensional. But really, just think of wrapping as just like, oh, it's still headed in one direction, but it just can't fit anymore. So it wraps down to the next line, but it's still headed in that same direction. Flexbox is kind of a 2D layout tool, whereas grid is literally a grid. And these words get screwed up a little bit because it's like, oh, a 12-column grid. When I said grid here, not that kind of grid, literally like graph paper grid. The CSS grid layout is a two-dimensional system. It's like, you know, I'm defining these horizontal lines and I'm defining these vertical lines. And now that I've done that, I have an opportunity to say any child of that display grid element, you know, start at this grid line and go these many lines down, start at this grid row, go these many rows over, and occupy that space of this grid. So it's very much a three, well, I should have said Flexbox and such is one dimensional, where grid is two dimensional. I think I might have screwed that up when I was talking, but that's a big deal. And once you think of, oh, two dimensional layout, wow. Any website you look at, in your mind, you can be like, oh, I see, I can envision this being done with grid layout. Go to Gmail, look at your mail. I'm looking at it on a pretty big screen. There's clearly like three columns here. Some of them go down all the way. Some of them don't. There's a header there. I think at some point we're all going to develop this muscle memory of just like, okay, I'm looking at this design. Let me code that up in CSS grid layout and go from there. I think eventually it's going to be the first thing we do. It's going to be the first thing taught in CSS is, let's describe this in CSS grid layout and then go from there. I think it's going to be kind of that big of a
deal. Yeah, I've heard grid layout described kind of like taking all the it's taking kind of all the learnings and things of CSS grids, like common frameworks or whatever, and putting it in the browser, and so you don't have this CSS overhead.
Kind of, but a bootstrap grid can't say, put something in the lower right-hand corner of this page. Right. There's no, that's not something that it is possible for it to do, but it is something that is possible to do with grid layout. It's like, describe the whole thing in two dimensions. It's hard to drive that home a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah. It has this kind of shorthand syntax for what you would normally do with like a bunch of floats and divs and classes. But then it has kind of some superpowers. Like it doesn't, you can kind of,
it should almost be called CSS layout.
Just layout. Finally, really a true layout system.
True layout thing. Yeah. And it's, you know, the word on the street is early 2017, a lot of implementations for grid will drop unprefixed in stable browsers. So it'll the day will come, and as we speak right now, none. So it's weird, and it's weird because Flexbox is becoming such a big deal. There's people shipping Flexbox on production sites all the time now. The support is pretty darn good for Flexbox, and we're hoping the same kind of thing goes down with Grid.
Yeah, and on mobile, there was a question about mobile responsiveness. I think if you do a mobile first code out, like min-width media queries, like it doesn't really matter because you just have a tube of content that actually is just display block. It doesn't even need a grid for most things, you know.
There is some concern about grid, but you know, I think this could apply back to floats even, in that we can change the visual order and you can change the source order as well. Like grid, you know, if you can just do anything you want, it doesn't really matter what source order it is, or there can be discrepancies in that, which may not be good for accessibility. There is thinking about that. Even the spec mentions it, and it encourages you to not get too crazy.
I was going to say, I'm going to, Dave Rupert LLC is going to, I'm going to re-CSS my whole website. Like I'm going to maybe a little bit of a redesign, but more of like just nudges. And I'm thinking about streaming it and recording it as I do it. If you're interested in that, I'm probably going to use a lot of Flexbox because I think a lot of components on my site do Flexbox. So, if stay on the lookout, follow me on Twitter at DavidTron5000 for that. Okay. Thanks. Hey, YouTube.
Hey, thanks.
Hey, guys. Well, thanks for tuning into my YouTube stream.
Based off our names.
Yeah.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Media Temple. One of the many things I love about Media Temple is just how long they've been around. I was in high school smoking cigarettes behind the bowling alley in 1998 when they started. I had no idea I'd even become a web designer and developer, and yet they were already a hosting company out there in LA, California, which is where they still are, which is great. Since then, they've just kind of quietly becoming a big, great, reliable web host. Love that. So one of the things I think you should understand about Media Temple is the breadth of hosting options that they offer. They have pretty inexpensive plans for shared hosting and stuff. Kind of starts at their dedicated WordPress hosting, which is optimized hosting just for WordPress. They know what they're doing with WordPress, which is great. I have a friend who recently came to me for help with their WordPress site, and I'm looking at it and trying to make it faster and clean up the code and stuff. And I'm like, you know what we also got to do is get you on some dedicated WordPress hosting that you can own, that you can manage, that it's just yours, and it's somewhere that I like trust to do this correctly. And then it kind of scales up from there. You know, they have DV plans and stuff. That's kind of like CSS hosting territory, where I need something a little more robust and a little more scalable and a little more control and stuff, and that's available for me. And it goes way up beyond that to like super hardcore servers that are fully managed or that are just really powerful but you manage. And then beyond that, even it's like they can basically be your server employees. You know, if like you need hardcore web hosting, but you just can't hire for that, or are trying and failing, or just you just want to basically have server people managing your servers for you, Media Temple offers that too. They'll even get you set up on AWS. They'll, you know, which seems like, aren't you competitors? Not really. They'll be your dedicated hosting people to set up and maintain and deal with AWS for you, which is amazing. Huge breadth of stuff available. Check out it all and compare plans and figure out what's right for you at mediatemple.net. Chris Colvin writes in, what are best practices for dealing with domain names and hosting for freelance clients? I have a classic question, I guess. Is it best to purchase the domain and hosting, then work with the client to transfer payment to them? Or is it best to deal with it on your own and send an invoice? Most of my clients aren't savvy enough to do things themselves. I'm afraid to try and walk them through their process. I have some recent experience with this where I wanted so badly to take control over the hosting because I just wanted to. I wanted to move it to something I was more familiar with and was more up to date and might be good for them. And I was like, I don't, you know what? Screw it. I don't want to be involved because I just don't want, I always regret it. I don't want to be the point person for this kind of thing. In the past, we've mentioned this in that's a big factor. in that how really hard is it? Can't you just go to their office or fire up a virtual conference of some kind and just have them share their screen and have you just walk themselves through it? I mean, even if they aren't savvy enough, they know how to move their mouse and click buttons and stuff. And if you're right there because you're in client services, you could walk them through it and explain why. Be like, I could die in a plane crash, God forbid. Or you could hate me tomorrow. You could find out I voted the other way and decide to sever ties with me or some crazy. I hope that never happens, but do something like that. Then I own your website. Do you want that? No, you want to own your website.
Yeah, it is tough. I'm just thinking, you got to what? Buy the domain. So you have to go sign up at wherever, GoDaddy.com. GoDaddy, this episode is brought to you by GoDaddy. They give us a bunch of money. No,
it's not, but they could.
I'm super down. Then you got to head over to Media Temple, the best servers on the planet, Media Temple, and get a brand new server. And then you got to point your name server to ns1.mediatemple.net, ms2.mediatemple.net. And that's asking a lot of the common person, I think. It took me kind of years to feel comfortable with that. But that said, I am super much a fan of the client owning that. I think it's really important. They have that information. They have that power. Like, I mean, you could send them an email or a Google Doc or something that outlines how to do that. That's, you know, not super secure, but it's fun. I think for a lot of people, it'll work. You could even password protect or something that, I mean, it's an issue. I was on a group text this week, Chris, a group text asking about the login to the server. And I was like, and I only had like one name on the group text. And I just was like, this is the worst. This is like a huge security problem. What is going on? Like, I had the heebie-jeebies. But yeah, I get, people just didn't know how to get in their server. So I think it is a problem. But I think I still stand by the fact that, like, that the company has to own that stuff, because you don't want to, whatever. If they quit paying for Typekit or whatever, what are you going to do? You're just going to turn the fonts off on their website? You know, do you feel good about that? Are you just going to shut down their domain and hosting? You could do that, but do you feel good about that?
It's good for everybody involved. Yeah,
we used to host client sites and like bill them, invoice them for hosting every year. You might be able to do that to like save some money or like make you some money and then save them some hassle. But what if the relationship goes sour? You know, what do you do then? Or what if they quit paying, you know? Do you have the guts to just turn the website off? I don't know. That's tough. So,
yeah, guts does come into it in some cases. You know, I definitely have one. I have a friend of my dad who I made a website for like 6 years ago, and I did this stuff, and he's a nice guy, and he's just like a contractor kind of dude, and he gets leads through the website, and like, I'm not proud of the website. I don't. But it's just that I just have some shared hosting. I just leave it up online. I also own his domain name. It's literally in my GoDaddy, and every year it comes up. It literally came up this week, and it just renewed, and I'm like, screw it. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to update the website, but I don't have the guts to turn it off, because turning it off leads to even more work, because then I get the call, and then it's
so this
whatever. Then what if the domain expires? Oh, what a hassle that is.
Your dad's friend costs you $20 a year.
And I'm like, fine.
Like, to not have to have the guilt of like just leaving him out to dry. You're just like, fine. Yeah. That's, you know, that's tough. So Adam Boucher writes in, have either of you guys set up HSTS preloading for a domain? I recently migrated a lot of client sites from HTTP to HTTPS, and now they're all rocking H2. That's HTTP2 for the unhip. My understanding is that by default, browsers look for HTTP version of domains first, unless the protocol was specified when the domain was entered. Then, if HTTPS is found, the browser sets up a new connection. HSTS looks to remove the initial non-secure request. I've just learned of this site for submitting domains, hstspreload.appspot.com, and wanted to make sure it was the right move to make for my clients, because accepted domains are hard-coded into Google Chrome. And you can see, like, there's a link to a, like, whatever transport security state static website. JSON. It's just a JSON list of like URLs basically, let's see, we got VeriSign, it's just a JSON list of URLs that sits inside your Google Chrome. Anyway, so thanks guys, love the show. So Chris, are you familiar with HTTP strict transport security?
No, absolutely not. It's totally above my head. This is interesting though. The first sentence on the Wikipedia entry is, it's a web security policy mechanism which helps to protect websites against protocol downgrade attacks and cookie hijacking. So it seems like kind of a big deal. And I guess what it seems like to me is like, okay, I went HTTPS only or whatever, I'm trying to force it. Can I like kind of ensure somehow that no non-secure stuff happens at all? And this is the mechanism in which to do that?
Yeah. So it's a header that you do. It's like the strict transport security header that you configure your server to send. I just did this on DaveRupert.com. I got that lock icon on DaveRupert.com because I was so embarrassed of my security score. I started locking down Dave Rupert. I'm writing a post. It's actually kind of more complicated than...
But, you know, you can get the lock by just going HTTPS. You don't have to go HSTS.
So there's three things. You get the SSL, the HTTPS. That gets you the lock. And then you have to redirect all requests. So that means you have to like configure Apache or Nginx to like force to port 443. Right. Then there's like these multiple redundancies. This HSTS header, it sort of says to the browser, it's like, hey, this needs to be secure. Like, make sure you requested this one secure, like over HTTPS. So it's kind of you have the server level like enforcement, but then this is like the file level enforcement. And then the browser sort of says, oh, okay, this was, you know, I know to get this file over HSTS. What I didn't know about this HSTS preload. I kind of read about it, but I just ignored it. But it's interesting, and it does not seem like scalable that Google would have like a billion website index inside Chrome. But
yeah, it does look weird. I'm like, it's like, oh, these are sites that are HTTPS only, essentially. Well, I'm HTTPS only. Why am I not on this list?
Right. And so I'm like, well, I should probably. Yeah, I'm like, well, I should add myself to it. And I don't think like it's wrong to add yourself to it. I think you probably should if it's free. If it's free, add yourself.
This is actually a fun. We got to do something fun with this. There's so many weird websites.
How about let's see how.
Some of them aren't even here. Some baby house XYZ is on here. It doesn't even resolve.
Oh man, there's no websites about butts. I'm gonna see how there's five. Hold on. There's butterfly greedbutt.com. Don't go to it. Oh no, Chris. Huskybutt.dog.
Is it bad? What? This list is so weird. There's bad.horse, which just links to one of those Dr. Horrible videos.
Oh my God. Let's find
this list of websites.
Dot horse. Tom.horse. Okay. Oh man. Okay.
They're only weird sites. There's no legit sites in this whole list. Right.
There's firefart.at. Thermo what? What? Thermost expensive work of fart. No, work of art. I don't know. Anyway, what a good
cheese.systems.
Oh man. Okay, send us, go through this list and find the best we'll put a link in the show notes. Go find the best domains you can find. That said, so this would be fun to add yourself to. Why not, right? This seems, I don't know. I would almost maybe not do it for my clients. It's kind of just one more thing. Unless they had that like extreme performance need. And that's usually kind of your bigger clients, you know, but excuse me.
I need to close this tab right now.
Too distracting.
Okay. James Haman writes in, I have a question about charging people as a freelance developer. I guess this can loads or goes right into the one before this one. I tend to undercharge Because I think I've always considered myself a bargain developer. Yeah, you're competing on price. It's a way to do it. Maybe not for everybody, but, you know, it's one of the principles of economics. When I first started a few years ago, I didn't know much, and I kind of relied on WordPress themes to do a lot of the non-HTML and CSS work for me. I've since learned a lot, enough to the point where I can build nice custom sites from scratch using JavaScript, MySQL, PHP, alongside HTML and SAS and stuff. Keeping up with the latest tools, I'm learning, I've come a long way. However, I still find myself charging bargain prices. I don't know if it's insecurity in myself or fear of not being competitive enough or what, but I haven't made the switch in my brain that says my time is worth more than bargain price. What can I do to change this? Something. So it sounds like you weren't necessarily competing on price. You didn't consciously say, I'm going to try to get as many clients as I can based on my price. You're just like charging too less and you'd like to charge more. So how can you get over that switch? I don't know. I've heard plenty of advice on this. You know, the advice people like to throw around is just like, think of your price and then triple it. You know, or like they say, you know, almost platitudes like that, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of advice guru stuff we could say here. We are advice gurus, but what I would say here, I mean, you have to figure out what, you know, you have to like increase your prices. I mean,
isn't going to feel good when you do it. Like maybe on a new client, so you don't even like potentially make mad an old client, which I think might be even dumb, but take a new client and just like try to literally double your price. And I know I hate to, you know, be using the same platitude or whatever, but see how it feels internally. Maybe you'll love it. Maybe you'll get addicted to increasing your price. And then you'll go up to the point where somebody says no. And then you'll be like, well, okay, apparently that was the limit.
Well,
maybe it'll change in your own body. Maybe you'll double your price and you'll get even better because you're like, oh, I'm charging them so much money. I'm going to make the best website ever. And then you do. And then you raise your price again and do it again. And pretty soon you're amazing.
Well, and it's sort of like, do you want to make, you know, 50 websites a year at a cheap cost, or do you want to make like 10 websites a year, you know, at a good cost, you know, like it's sort of like volume pricing too, you know, what do you want to do? I've been doing this, Dave Goes Windows thing. People ask me all the time about computers to buy. I'm not throwing shade. I enjoy these questions, but sometimes people are like, oh man, this one's like, you know, going to be $400 more. What, you know, that's tough. And I understand that like coming up with $400 is tough, but the back of my brain, I'm just like, oh, if you're making websites, just charge $400 more on that next website and you paid for it, you know, like get a credit card and then just like, you could, you know, you should be able to make up that, like that $400 pretty quick. Or if I remember somebody was like, oh, I want this apartment, but it's like $100 more a month than I'm willing to spend. You could raise your rate, you know, what's that, like $2 an hour, you know, if you're working 4 hours a week, or man, it's $1 an hour. So, I mean, you can make up money pretty quick. If you just think about it, you know, if you want another, whatever, if you work 120 hours a month and you want another $120, that's one more dollar. Well,
it sounds like James wants some. James, you're looking for somebody to tell you to do it, I think. So just, it's Dave and I.
Do it.
We're telling you to do it. Do it. I think that's what you want. That's what you got. Benjamin Hughes writes in, I have a question regarding JavaScript and browser history. I work in Denmark. I make websites, I use a lot of JavaScript and handlebars for the templating. In some of the apps, it's made sense to change the view with the back button, like literal browser back button. It seems quite intimidating, though. Have you tried doing this, and what do you think? So, it's making a website, the content's coming in with JavaScript, being templated with handlebars, but there's some kind of, you know, there's stuff happens, right? You click a button, you click a link, you click something, and new content arrives. It comes in with JavaScript. It is formatted with handlebars. The user has clicked on the link and they're a user. They know how browsers work. I want that to go away. I want to be looking at what I was just looking at. I'm going to hit the back button in the browser, but uh-oh, that didn't trigger a a native browser URL change kind of thing. It's on you to figure out what's going on there. So how would you approach that, Dave?
This is maybe less JavaScript, but on Daytrip, we were doing a thing where you had it like a, you had a list of spots. That's kind of what Daytrip is. And then we had a map view, and it was like, oh, click the map view. The map shows up, you know, Ajax is in. And I was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to, like, you know, that should probably be like a back button thing. So I started going down this whole push state route. And that's, it's like the history API. You can look, Google that, MDN that, but it is, the history API is, built for this. And you just say like, whatever, is it history.pushState or yeah, like window.history.pushState, and then you...
And replace state, right? Replace, so push state is the one that's like, throw it on the old stack so that the back button does work, and replace state is like, change the URL, but don't throw it on the
stack. Yeah, so it's just sneak this URL in there, but don't affect the back button. Push state affects the back button. And it was great. It worked. I started getting into a little bit of like, I don't know. It worked, but it also like didn't. Does that make like, it just was unintuitive because you're like, you clicked a page, but it didn't refresh the page. It just kind of swapped out a div. The content was all still there. I just was sort of like, and we ended up actually like, just like, it was just like, why are we doing like, I don't know. It was like, we should just isolate all this stuff to one page. Like we're requesting this, all this map Ajax and stuff for something that never renders. And then we have to like trigger the render when we click the tab, and then it goes to the thing. And I just was like, let's just make it as like a server side rendered page, you know, and it worked out great. So I don't know. I think like it's tough. Like, when you build JavaScript apps, you're not really thinking like, oh, this should just be a server-side rendered page, because you don't have a server typically. So I've done this. It's good. The push state thing is great. However, I'm also not afraid of like just falling back to a server state URL. That was my TLDR.
Right. I mean, I guess I would prefer that too. It feels like the progressive enhancement kind of way to do, and just a kind of a comfortable way to do it. Be like, oh, this URL renders this content. And if I want to level up, I can, but I have that fallback in case like anything goes wrong at all. Mm-hmm. Feels good. Just feels good. But you have this really fun base to build from too. You can be like, okay, now I got this URL that serves me exactly the page and exactly the format that I want it. Maybe I'll write a little router that like, if .json is at the end of the URL, it's not going to give me any of the like HTML stuff around it. It's like just going to give me the content of that thing. Like, that's pretty cool. Now I have that. Now I'll have it. Now I'll like write a little JavaScript that like hijacks all the internal links on this page, because I know those internal links have this like .json variant of them. And I'll override the default action of clicking that link. And when that link is clicked, I'm going to check out the URL. I'm going to append .json to the end of it, make an Ajax request for that data. I got the content. Now I can just write a little bit of DOM manipulation to swap out the content on that page. Now you have like a progressive enhanced cool site that like presumably is a little faster because the JSON request is a lot smaller than the HTML one is, and the browser doesn't have to refresh its whole self.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, cool, I've built a one-page site with like a handful of lines of JavaScript. Oh, shoot, though, what I should have done is when they click it, I also need to write what Dave was talking about, that push state thing. And I'll change the URL to what the link, what it normally would have happened. Okay, did that, cool. Now the back button kind of works, or at least the URL is going to change. Ooh, I need to do one more thing. I need to watch for a change in the URL. So like if they click another link, or if they hit the back button, the browser is going to do the right thing. It's going to change the URL. So I need to be listening for that. And I set up a little listener. It's like, oh, if the URL changes, do the same stuff you would do if a user clicked on a link. Like fire off those same functions that do the replacing of the content. So it shouldn't be too bad. And there's probably like little frameworks you can use to do it. But I kind of prefer to think through it like that and attempt to write it yourself before you reach for something that tries to, you know, do it its own weird way.
Yeah, there's kind of the click action, the update the URL, and then listen for URL changes or like back buttons or whatever. Like, I had a situation in with Daytrip. We were doing like a filtering or sorting sort of UI thing. And I think I ended up using replace state because I wanted, if the user navigated away from the page and they hit the back button, I wanted them to come back to that state, like, and
sorted the same way.
And so I catch the sort param, and then I like re-render the list. And it's probably not like, there might be a flash of content, but like, it usually it's all cached. And so it happens really, really quick. But that it was kind of like, it was cool, like getting into like using replace state and things like that. I don't have to set cookies and do all that. I can kind of like create state in from my URL. And I kind of like that.
Yeah. It's tricky though. Like when you start getting into that, cause okay, now you're looking at the same exact URL, but it has, but it's sort of the different way. So you're like, you have to make this call, like, oh, are we going to make it the URL slash ascending or slash descending? Or is like, is this just not seem like an important enough UI thing to deal with that? Which it may be the case. Or like in some, so like we have all three on CodePen in different places. There's places where it changes the URL. So it's like, okay, no, I'm looking at my pens in ascending order. So we really do change the URL to do that because you should be able to link to that page in that state. Then there's times where like, okay, we have some sortability and there's just, it's just a cosmetic change to the UI you're looking at right now. And there's no way to like link to that specifically. And then we have a third way that just kind of remembers where you left it and it sets a cookie and it will attempt to use that cookie information to kind of do what, so that when you come back, it's about how you left it. That's it, though. So there's kind of three ways you can think about it.
Which one's your least favorite? The cookie, right?
Probably, because it doesn't persist across browsers and stuff. And like, oh, okay, do you write to the user object that remembers, you know, like you could do that. And that might even be better because then you could do it server side instead of front end only. Because if you're doing it with just a cookie on the front end, you have to like load the page, then look at that cookie, then do another request to the server. Because sorting isn't just like, I have all the data in the DOM, and I'm just going to sort the data in the DOM. Sorting is usually like there's thousands of things and I'm only showing 100 of them. So the sorting information needs to hit the server too to only give me the 20 they're looking at, you know? Oh, there's web development is hard.
And it doesn't work in Europe because they hate cookies. Ugh, Europe. Gosh.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is sponsored in part by Indeed Prime. Indeed Prime helps tech talent such as software developers and data scientists simplify their job search and land their dream job. Candidates get immediate exposure to the best tech companies with just one simple application to Indeed Prime. Companies on Prime's exclusive platform message candidates with salary and equity information up front. The average software developer gets 5 employer contacts and an average salary offer of $125,000. Pretty good jobs here on Indeed Prime. Indeed Prime is 100% free for you, for candidates. No strings attached. When you're hired, Indeed Prime gives you $2,000 bonus to say thanks for using Prime. That's a pretty hearty thank you. I used to shake the guy's hand, he got me a job. I'll take the $2,000. That's better. Sign up now at Indeed.com/Prime.
I got a question here from an old guy. All right. Jackson Bates writes in. Follow-up question. And this may be our last one here because we are running out of time, dollars, podcast minutes. And I got to up my AOL. I got to update my AOL minutes here. So we're...
It's 11:15. I don't have it.
Podcast minutes. Here we go. Okay, follow-up question. Off the last episode's oldies and tech question. That was a couple episodes ago here. I'm one of those, been teaching 10 years, kind of sick of it, newbies, looking to get into a dev career. I'm reasonably sure it's possible for me, 34 years old, not long, too long in the tooth, but I really struggle with the idea. I'll have to start again from the bottom. I've got a toddler, a second baby on the way, a mortgage, and a wife accustomed to a certain lifestyle. Do you think it's possible to leapfrog a junior, whatever that means, starting salary so that I don't have to take a significant pay cut? I know I have some killer soft skills and general professional experience up my sleeve that would mark me out as way more hireable than your average 20-something. But I appreciate that if those 20-somethings just know more than me, then my firm handshake, winsome smile, and can-do attitude might not be enough. So hopefully these soft skills, I think Jackson's hoping, kind of account for something. If it is possible, what kind of practices or technologies should I try to get under my belt to try more convincingly market myself as somebody worth a better salary, even though I'm going to be going for my first tech jobs?
I love this, don't you? Because it's I think it probably strikes a lot of people out there, and strikes a lot of people who are doing the dev camp kind of thing. And he's not even old. You're younger than me, Jackson. 34 years old, was a teacher, and wants to switch careers, but doesn't really want to start at the bottom, which I think is kind of fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I mean, to some degree, you're probably going to have to. You're not going to roll into a senior dev position with zero dev experience. But can you get a job where they recognize that you're a little bit more valuable than a 19-year-old or whatever? Not that any 19-year-old, like being 19, just makes you less valuable. I'm not trying to say that, but Jackson does have a lot here. This email was really well written, and it's nice. I can kind of get the vibe from Jackson that he does have pretty good soft skills. Although, I mean, I know I'm reading a lot into an email or whatever, but just a well-written email goes a long way. I've kind of joked that, like, I think that's a really big deal, that, like, I would almost hire somebody based on, like, can you write a killer email? That's almost more valuable to me than, somebody that knows all six of the frameworks.
All six frameworks necessary.
Yeah, that soft skills stuff is a big deal. So can you roll into someone and be like, look, I'm going for my first tech job here. I've learned a lot. I have some tech job skills. But in addition to that, I'm a high-functioning, soft skills-laden, generally pleasurable adult.
Okay.
Is there a mid-range role for me? Can I not start as the absolute low end? I don't know if that's the deal, though. I mean, tech jobs, you know, if salary is the differentiator for you, Jack, and I suspect that it is because of the, you know, family that expects, you know, you have two babies or, you know, one and one on the way, and a wife that don't necessarily want to switch back to ramen or whatever. Tech jobs might not be a bad way to go. A lot of these boot camps or whatever, and I've heard, you know, I've started to hear a little drama that these, like, promised salaries aren't necessarily what they are. They have a weird methodology for getting it. But I don't doubt that they're landing a lot of people 100K jobs. And that's a wheelbarrow full of money, if you ask me.
Yeah, from, like, a teacher position. Yeah.
Or anybody, I would hope.
I would say, like, you know, if you're moving to tech, your salary's more probably going to be like a lateral move into a junior position. And then I don't know this to be true, but I think, you know, someone with soft skills is probably going to get more projects because they're not hard to deal with. As long as you can complete those projects, let's say everyone can complete the projects at the same time, but you're going to get more projects. You're going to be in more meetings because you're more pleasurable to be in meetings with. You're going to, you know, have a little more a workplace attention to yourself. And that probably will get you, you know, kind of moving you up the ladder, the social ladder, or the,
if there even is one,
if there even is one,
there's plenty of places that don't have one, you know, like, there is no ladder for you to climb at CodePen. Yeah. We're not even hiring at the moment, but, you know, we're coming up at the end of the year, and, you know, it's like, God, I don't know, I can't give you promotions because it would just be changing your business card on the thing that you designed yourself, because we don't have business cards.
Right. Right. It might not even pay off like that. So I don't know. I think, like, you would be in a good position. I think that's, you know, we get We've had the question here on Shop Talk before. It's like, no one gives me work or no one, you know, hires me, blah. And it's like kind of clear by the email, right, that that the question we got, that that this person has maybe a chip on their shoulder or just kind of is a hard person to deal with. And I think there's actually a difference. I think soft skills make a huge, huge difference. You know, being a developer, I can say from my experience, being a developer that can also like break things down in plain English and being a developer who can kind of work through problems, like complicated technical problems in plain English, that's very useful for companies. So I think it's a skill. So I think, you know, how do you like whatever, explain something like HSTS, like the problems surrounding HSTS or something to, you know, your boss who really just wants a website. You know, it's I think you're in a better position if you can do that.
Good luck, Mr.
Good luck. Yeah. Welcome to tech. It's great. I have a lot of friends who moved from teaching and, I think you'll be good. All right, Chris, we got to shut her down. Thank you for, talking with me today. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher's choice. Starheart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Tweet about the show. We really appreciate that. If you hate your t-shirt or hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com where you can get one of each. It'll be great.
Hey, listeners in the UK, we have a job we'd like to tell you about. It's a job in London at an agency. The agency is Lighthouse London. They're looking for a front-end developer. That could be you. They're looking for someone with about a year of experience to aid the team in producing fantastic web experiences. They are, you know, your job is implementing designs. Personally, that's one of my favorite things to do in the whole world. Get a design and turn it into a functional, responsive template using HTML, and it looks like they're a SaaS shop. That's pretty sweet. They're looking for someone who's creative, someone who's into animations and clever interactions and SVG wizardry. Perfect for Shop Talk Show listeners. They're a WordPress shop. They use JavaScript and jQuery or whatever. You just need to be a creative person that knows the kind of stuff that we talk about here on Shop Talk Show. So all of you, if you're a UK developer, apply for this role. Try to get in at Lighthouse. It looks like a small team that does awesome work. They've been around for like 7 years. The job description is well written. Go read it. See if this is you. See if you need a change. See if you want to go work at a shop that's producing both content-driven sites and working with entrepreneurs and startups and stuff, building more functional app-like websites and stuff. They do it all. Looks like an amazing opportunity at an amazing agency. Go check out the front-end developer role. And so we'll have a link in the show notes to this. It'll be up on the Shop Talk Show job board. So that's shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Very easy to find the job posting for this. Go apply for it. Change up your life.
And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to share?
ShopTalkShow.com.